Whether Iraq succeeds in developing its own national police force will largely depend on whether U.S. and Iraqi forces ever quell insurgent violence there. It will also depend on whether Michael Hidingsfield stays alive. Mr. Hidingsfield is the contingent commander of the State Department's Civilian Police Advisory Mission in Iraq. He oversees police training in Baghdad and Mosul, as well as the training of Iraqi cadets in neighboring Jordan. Mr. Hidingsfield is in the United States on a short leave, his first visit home in 6 months. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're the former police chief of Scottsdale, Arizona, and crime commissioner of Memphis and Shelby County.
That is correct.
You're on a one-year contract with DynCorp International to build a police force in Iraq.
Yes.
What can be done in a year?
Our original thoughts, or I should say those who made the policy decisions, had original thoughts that an entire security force could be created that would stabilize the country very quickly. I think we've learned that bringing stability to Iraq is going to be a much more onerous task.
Is it better, safer, wiser to train Iraqi recruits outside of Iraq?
Well, I think you can make the argument that it is safer because then they're not targets during their time of learning. The counterforces at work are the logistics of moving thousands of Iraqi police trainees to a location outside of Iraq, as we do sometimes now to Jordan, is enormous. And severing them for a significant period of time from their family and community support systems often makes them less able to focus on the learning that has to occur. So you could probably make an equally persuasive argument that it's just as successful to train them within Iraq as it is to go outside.
Your headquarters, as I understand it, are outside of that famous green zone.
We are in what they call the red zone.
Why are you there as opposed to the green zone?
A number of reasons. The green zone can only accommodate so many forces. Originally in the spring of 2003, following the invasion, I think the sense was that being close to the center of the heartbeat of Baghdad would make us better positioned to interact with our Iraqi police counterparts day in and day out. Once again, our inability to anticipate the level of violence and insurgency then put us in a position where we live at ground zero, frankly, in two different facilities.
Does the security under which you have to function inhibit your ability to provide security to Iraqi citizens?
Well, we're not directly in the business of providing security to Iraqi citizens. That mission falls directly to the United States Army and its coalition partners. But we cannot move other than in armored convoys with gunners and protective details surrounding us. Our ability to what I call loiter and stay on target is significantly impacted at Iraqi police stations because some of them are such high-value targets or so soft that our presence beyond a half an hour makes us extraordinarily vulnerable to attack. And then, of course, the Iraqi police suffer the consequences of that attack as well. So, yes, we are tremendously impacted by the security environment.
We've heard reports about some new tactics among insurgents, handcuffing suicide bombers to car steering wheels, asking unsuspecting people to carry packages that turn out to be explosives. What do you make of some of these tactics and others?
I have personally encountered suspects who have been duct taped to their steering wheel and duct taped to the accelerator. We have found them handcuffed to their steering wheel, and then they have no choice because the explosives are going to be remotely detonated. Satchel bombers are a constant threat during the elections. We were told specifically to watch for drunkards and those people suffering from mental illness who were simply scraped off the street and coerced into doing whatever was required. Our biggest fear is improvised explosive devices on the side of the road, which you can rarely see, or the vehicle bombers who cruise the streets of Baghdad looking for an opportunistic target.
We read a profile of you in the, I believe, it Memphis Commercial Appeal, which it said that you just catnap throughout the day. You can't really sleep a whole night through.
That's correct. When I first got there, I think in some ways I was blissfully ignorant, and I actually could find a good night's sleep from time to time once you got accustomed to the nearly constant gunfire that takes place after dark. But after the bombing of my hotel, I sleep every night with the window cracked so I can hear exactly what's going on outside. Mm-hmm. I have a machine gun in my bed with me. I have guards outside my door, and I'm afraid to go to sleep.
Your hotel was bombed, I believe, last March, right?
March 9th at 6:29 in the morning.
Could you recall for us what happened as you remember it?
I woke up at 6:28, 2 minutes before my alarm went off. At 6:29, there was an enormous explosion. What we later learned was that the insurgents had packed 3,000 pounds of high explosives into a standard municipal garbage truck. They had armored the front passenger area so it would be bullet resistant, and they had a machine gunner in the passenger seat. They came across the north parking lot, and they crashed into our northern retaining wall. The driver apparently made the decision to detonate, and he did so. And the Army has told us it is the largest single vehicle-borne improvised explosive device in Iraq since the war started. We had 48 casualties, 38 of whom were U.S. or expatriate, 10 of whom were Iraqi. It blew my windows in and blew me out of bed. The hallway outside collapsed. My door disappeared. There were wounded stumbling around through the entire hotel. Every piece of glass was gone. By 6:50, it was all over. But it was a horrific morning. And I think it changed everybody's lives profoundly.
How so?
When you walk through the lobby of what was a hotel and is now essentially a commandeered military or State Department facility, and you see people walking around with 1,000-yard stares, shrapnel in their bodies, bleeding, can't see, I think it would be foolish and naive to suggest that anyone can come through that with not being fundamentally changed. It doesn't mean it has to alter them in a way that makes them dysfunctional. I just think it changes them. It certainly changed me.
May I ask, Vice President Cheney notably said that the insurgency in Iraq is, I believe the phrase he used, in its last throes. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'd preface my response by saying this is just me as Mike Heidingsfield speaking now, not as speaking as the contingent commander. In the last 30 days, we clearly have begun to make an impact through the military interdictive missions. That said, it would be difficult for me to characterize the insurgency as being in its last throes because I don't see anything that conclusively indicates that. And my greatest fear is that with the munitions and explosives cached across this country, and they are everywhere, there's no question about that, and the rival ethnic, tribal, and religious groups vying for power, and the reemergence of the criminal element, which clearly had been quashed under the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, when you put all those elements at play, that's too much fodder for at least a modestly successful insurgency that could go on indefinitely.
Michael Heidingsfield, who commands the State Department Civilian Police Advisory Mission in Iraq, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.